Continuing with the Dhammanupassana Satipatthana, and this begins with the hindrances, and in the Majjhima Nikaya, in the Satipatthana Sutta, there's the hindrances, five khandhas, six sense bases, seven factors of enlightenment, four noble truths. And the next few readings that I'll give there's an interplay between the hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment. Which is a useful aspect to be considering in terms of practice, that it's not just a matter of looking at all the things that are wrong with the mind, but looking at what are the things that are also there that can be encouraged and supported, which lead to awakening. It's necessary to understand the hindrances. It's necessary to have a very clear recognition of the danger of allowing the hindrances to overwhelm the mind. But it's also necessary to not forget those aspects that brighten and enliven the mind, so that these suttas are suttas that are they're kind of intertwined, hindrances and the bojangas. And it's also interesting that in the Chinese agamas, the Satipatthana Sutta in the middle length agamas from the Chinese tradition, then that Satipatthana discourse has the that when the Dhammanupassana has two things of the hindrances, and five hindrances, seven factors of enlightenment. Many of the discourses in the agamas are very, very, very early. As a kind of a backup or a support for that being quite old, didn't they? In the Pali, Vibhanga, the Abhidham, the one of the very early Abhidhamma texts, when the Satipatthana is talked about, then the Dhammanupassana is five hindrances and seven factors of enlightenment. So it's it could be that was the fairly original basis of the Dhammanupassana, and then as time went on, then there was the felt the need to add the other elements, which are still very useful, necessary aspects of investigation. But seeing how those two are seen to be linked, hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment, that they are kind of intertwined and kind of work together, so that, and I think in particularly in practice, not just spending all the time looking at the hindrances, but also paying attention to those factors of enlightenment, the aspects of beginning with, of course, the first one is sati, then dhammavicaya. I mentioned it the other day, talked about that, dhammavicaya, investigation of dhamma, virya, effort, piety, joy, paccity, tranquility, samadhi, firm establishing of the mind, and equanimity, and kind of stability, steadiness, evenness of mind. So this, these next few suttas that I read are all from, are actually all from the Bhojanga Samyutta, and I'll just begin. When bhikkhus, a noble disciple, listens to the Dhamma with eager ears, attending to it as a vital matter of vital concern, directing his whole mind to it, on that occasion the five hindrances are not present in him. On that occasion, the seven factors of enlightenment go to fulfillment by development. And what are the five hindrances that are not present on that occasion? The hindrance of sensual desire is not present on that occasion. The hindrance of ill will, the hindrance of sloth and torpor, the hindrance of restlessness and remorse, the hindrance of doubt is not present on that occasion. These are the five hindrances that are not present on that occasion. And what are the seven factors of enlightenment that go to fulfillment by development on that occasion? The enlightenment factor of mindfulness goes to fulfillment by development on that occasion, and goes through them, through to equanimity. These are the seven factors of enlightenment that go to fulfillment by development on that occasion. When bhikkhus, a noble disciple, listens to the Dhamma with eager ears, attending to it as a matter of vital concern, directing his whole mind to it, on that occasion, these five hindrances are not present in him. On that occasion, these seven factors of enlightenment go to fulfillment by development. So that's an interesting perspective in recognizing the value of listening to Dhamma, attending to the Dhamma teachings, and that it's not a small thing to be listening to Dhamma, and there's also it's actually one of the where the heck is that sutta? I think it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the listening to Dhamma is seen as one of the means of entering the stream of Dhamma, of enlightenment. Having the hindrances in abeyance by paying attention to the seven factors for enlightenment, while one's listening to Dhamma, there is that opportunity for awakening. And of course, you read the discourses, and there's just so many discourses people, that is their entry into the stream of Dhamma is through listening to Dhamma. Next sutta is, and these are all, they're actually in a series. There's three of them in a series. Bhikkhus, there are huge trees with tiny seeds and huge bodies, encirclers of other trees, and the trees which they encircle become bent, twisted, and split. And what are those huge trees with tiny seeds and huge bodies? The asata, the banyan, the pilaka, the udambara, the kachaka, and the kapittana. So those are, I guess there's Those are huge trees, and there are five trees. Huge trees with tiny seeds and huge bodies, encirclers of other trees, and the trees which they encircle become bent, twisted, and split. So too, bhikkhus, when some clansman here has left behind sensual pleasures and gone forth from the household life into homelessness, he becomes bent, twisted, and split because of those same sensual pleasures or because of others worse than them. These five bhikkhus are obstructions, hindrances, encirclers of the mind, weakeners of wisdom. What five? Sensual desire is an obstruction, a hindrance encircling the mind, a weakener of wisdom. Ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, doubt is an obstruction, a hindrance encircling the mind, a weakener of wisdom. These are the five obstructions, hindrances, encirclers of the mind, weakeners of wisdom. These seven factors of enlightenment, bhikkhus, are non-obstructions, non-hindrances, non-encirclers of the mind. When developed and cultivated, they lead to the realization of the fruit of true knowledge and liberation. What seven? The enlightenment factor of mindfulness is a non-obstruction. The enlightenment factor of investigation of dhammas is a non-obstruction. The enlightenment factor of energy is a non-obstruction. The enlightenment factor of joy is a non-obstruction. The enlightenment factor of tranquility is a non-obstruction. The enlightenment factor of concentration is a non-obstruction. The enlightenment factor of equanimity is a non-obstruction. These seven factors of enlightenment are non-obstructions, non-hindrances, non-encirclers of the mind. When developed and cultivated, they lead to the realization of the fruit of true knowledge and liberation. Those trees are all different, five of them, all five of them they're kind of in the fig tree family, the banyan, these fig trees, and they're called strangling figs. Do we have them here, anything like that? Yeah, we've got a fig tree. Fruit fig tree, but not like these, because you can really see them, they take over the trees, and just, that's where, you know, there's this very famous image of, like I think it's from Ayutthaya maybe, or in Cambodia, of the head of the Buddha sort of, you know, surrounded with his roots.
Ayutthaya, I saw it.
Yeah. So those are, that's a kind of fig tree that goes around something and just, and they also just go around whole trees, and then they grow up with the trees get strangled and die, and then the kind of the fig or the, that they stand up.
In New Zealand, kind of Vivuvata, the seeds grow up in the top of the tree, and they shoot their roots down.
And
it grows around the tree and runs the tree.
Starts from top and goes down. Yeah,
and it completely destroys the tree.
Yeah. Well, that's the hindrances. Starts from the head and just works down. Okay. Next one. This is Sanyutta 46, 38, 39, and 40. Bhikkhus, these five hindrances are makers of blindness, causing lack of vision, causing lack of knowledge, detrimental to wisdom, tending to vexation, leading away from Nibbana. What five? The hindrance of sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse. Hindrance of doubt is a maker of blindness, causing lack of vision, causing lack of knowledge, detrimental to wisdom, tending to vexation, leading away from Nibbana. These seven factors of enlightenment, bhikkhus, are makers of vision, makers of knowledge, promoting the growth of wisdom free from vexation, leading towards Nibbana. And what seven? Of course, the enlightenment factor of mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, equanimity. These seven factors of enlightenment are makers of vision, makers of knowledge, promoting the growth of wisdom, free from vexation, leading towards Nibbana. Because that's exactly what is that when we chant the Dhammacakka Sutta, it's this Eightfold Path, this middle way is a maker of vision, a maker of knowledge. Jhaku karani, jnana karani. So that karani is to make, to bring into being. So that making a vision, maker of knowledge. So the Buddha applying that similarly to the seven factors of enlightenment. Now, the next sutta is a bit more extensive, but it's similarly continuing with that theme of the interplay between these hindrances and the these factors of enlightenment, and how they are to be attended to. Okay, at Savati. This is Samyutta 46 and Bojanga Samyutta and Sutta number 55. At Savati. Then the Brahmin Sangarava approached the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, what is the cause and reason why sometimes even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited? What is the cause and reason why sometimes those hymns that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited? Or in our parts, why is it sometimes we can remember the chanting and sometimes we can't? Which that happened when I was in Thailand, chanting the Parittas twice on the, like, at Yom Tam. I was getting to the end of my time, and I think it was just my mind was just so looking forward to getting on the plane and getting out of him, but doing the Paritta chanting and then chanting along and then realizing I didn't have no idea where I was. Even though I obviously know the chanting, but it's one thing to know the chanting, it's the other to, when the hindrances are clouding the mind, then you may as well not know it because you can't remember it. Okay, anyway. Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by sensual lust, overwhelmed by sensual lust, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen sensual lust, on that occasion, one neither knows nor sees it as it really is one's own good or the good of others or the good of both. Then even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water mixed with lac, turmeric, blue dye, or crimson dye. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by sensual lust, on that occasion even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by ill will, overwhelmed by ill will, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen ill will, on that occasion one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good, or the good of others, or the good of both. Then even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water being heated over a fire, bubbling and boiling. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by ill will, on that occasion even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by sloth and torpor, overwhelmed by sloth and torpor, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen sloth and torpor, on that occasion one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good or the good of others or the good of both. Then even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water covered over with water plants and algae. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by sloth and torpor, on that occasion, even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by restlessness and remorse, overwhelmed by restlessness and remorse, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen restlessness and remorse, on that occasion one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good or the good of others or the good of both. Then even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water stirred by the wind, rippling, swirling, churned into wavelets. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by restlessness and remorse, on that occasion, even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Again, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by doubt, overwhelmed by doubt, and one does not understand as it really is the escape from arisen doubt, on that occasion one neither knows nor sees as it really is one's own good or the good of others or the good of both. Then even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water that is turbid, unsettled, muddy, placed in the dark. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would neither know nor see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind obsessed by doubt, on that occasion, even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. This, Brahman, is the cause and reason why even those hymns that have been recited over a long period do not recur to the mind, let alone those that have not been recited. Brahman, when one dwells with a mind that is not obsessed by sensual lust, not overwhelmed by sensual lust, and one understands as it really is the escape from arisen sensual lust, on that occasion one knows and sees as it really is one's own good and the good of others and the good of both. Then even those hymns that have not been recited over a long period of time recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water not mixed with lac, turmeric, blue dye, or crimson dye. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would know and see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind that is not obsessed by sensual lust, on that occasion, even those hymns that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited. So the Buddha goes through those images with ill will, so that it's a bowl of water that has not been heated, it's not bubbling, not boiling, and one would be able to see one's facial reflection. And then sloth and torpor. There's a bowl of water that is not covered over with water plants and algae. With restlessness and remorse. As a bowl of water that is not stirred by wind, without ripples, without swirls, not churned into wavelets, so that one with good sight would be able to examine one's own facial reflection. With doubt, as the mind is, one dwells with a mind that is not obsessed by doubt. Suppose, Brahman, there is a bowl of water that is clear, serene, limpid, set out in the light. If a man with good sight were to examine his own facial reflection in it, he would know and see it as it really is. So too, Brahman, when one dwells with a mind that is not obsessed by doubt, on that occasion, even those hymns that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited. This, Brahman, is the cause and reason why even those hymns that have not been recited over a long period recur to the mind, let alone those that have been recited. These seven factors of enlightenment, Brahman, are non-obstructions, non-hindrances, non-corruptions of the mind. When developed and cultivated, they lead to the realization of the fruit of true knowledge and liberation. What seven? The enlightenment factor of mindfulness is a non-obstruction. The enlightenment factor of investigation of dhammas is a non-obstruction. The enlightenment factor of energy is a non-obstruction. The enlightenment factor of joy is a non-obstruction. The enlightenment factor of tranquility is a non-obstruction. The enlightenment factor of concentration is a non-obstruction. The enlightenment factor of equanimity is a non-obstruction. These seven factors of enlightenment are non-obstructions, non-hindrances, non-corruptions of the mind. When developed and cultivated, they lead to the realization of the fruit of true knowledge and liberation. When this was said, the Brahman Sangharava said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent. From today, let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life." So that's images, of course, that are quite well known, but it's always good to go over some of these, especially what seems sometimes see in the context of where the, say, the suttas, where the images come from, the similes, and seeing the because oftentimes we're familiar with the simile, but we forget the actual sutta that it comes in, and good to see that oftentimes the. Sometimes the context as well of seeing again where the sutta is not with these vivid images of the hindrances is not a sutta solely about the hindrances, but it's the hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment working together, so that we're learning how to both support and encourage one's practice by being able to relinquish those five hindrances, but then also the bringing into being the arising of these factors of enlightenment. Any questions? Yeah.
The question I have has to do with enlightenment factors.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that when it comes to the hindrances, for example, I have a sort of small moment of familiarity
with
how they're experienced by the mind.
Yeah.
But with enlightenment factors, some of the terms are still kind of more vague.
Uh-huh, right.
And probably because of pre-existing associations with the different words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, for example, enlightenment factor of joy, whenever you read about it in the sutras.
Right.
It usually seems that it's something that naturally arises by itself. It's not something you actually cultivate. It just sort of comes about as a result of the result of attending loss.
Right.
So it seems like that joy, tranquility, even concentration, and everything that can come about as a result, basically a result of putting in the factors. to cause them to arise directly.
Right.
So, by contrast to him, it says you use a fine pig and not kind of coarse pig.
Right.
There are some ways where actually how to sort of cause something to change. And I'm wondering if you guys talked about the cultivation of those factors sort of other than the things.
Right. Well, I think with the that's one where that investigation of dhammas is very helpful, and familiarizing oneself with those things that do elicit, say, a feeling of joy or of well-being. Sometimes joy is. Again, the words in English can be fairly loaded or have preconceived ideas of what it should be.
Is it the technical term also in Catholicism?
Double whammy. So that and say the word in Pali, bhiti, and bhiti can be displayed in many, many different ways. So just because sometimes it's even translated as zest, because it's just kind of like when you're, say, meditating, the mind starts to set a little bit, there's a bit of clarity come, a bit of focus, and then there's, all of a sudden there's, you're sort of like starting, you feel like you're starting to wake up. And that is bhiti. Or I can remember like Ajahn Chah saying, when you're doing a breath meditation, or you're meditating, well, it doesn't necessarily have to be breath meditation, but you're you're meditating, and there's the mind's just starting to settle, and there's this feeling of like when you breathe, and it's sort of, and you just kind of, there's a, it's like, oh, there's this kind of a shiver of kind of well-being and kind of an energizing quality. But that's bhiti. So that it's not so, utterly refined or spectacular. It's, reasonably common. We all experience it. And it's sort of like reminding oneself of that, because that's also a factor of mindfulness, is like reminding oneself, or like anusati is like a recollection. Recollecting, remember, because that's one of the functions of sati, because one of its main roots is also in the root of memory. So recollecting, remembering. So just remembering a quality, an association of well-being and ease. And so that like pasati is tranquility. But pasati has its displays itself more in the body, in the sense of it's like an ease within the body, a relaxing in the body, so that those are one can be quite consciously just really attending to relaxing and settling. So that one's proactively engaging one's attention and recollection, so that those one is eliciting those states of mind or states of being. And I think it's really important to in the practice to recognize that one can do that rather than being a passive recipient of some kind of perceived good karma that one's creating. You know, so that everything has to be absolute. You know, the stars have to all align properly before one can experience a particular a feeling or mental state. But then once you're starting to recognize, oh no, I can be actually eliciting and remembering, recollecting. These are qualities of mind that are utterly wholesome. And that's an idiom that sticks in my mind from the suttas or the translation of the suttas. So, utterly wholesome. I thought, well, that's just really interesting. Just something, completely good. And you realize, oh yeah, and what I'm actually doing is actually utterly wholesome. Just sitting here, breathing in and breathing out, and maintaining an intention of goodness.